Hello everyone and welcome to the Pop That Mama podcast. In this episode, I have midwife Vic with us, which is so exciting. I'm a massive fan of her work. She's on the podcast to talk about how to avoid unnecessary intervention. She is also the headline speaker for the brand new festival that we've got going on in central London on the 3rd of February next year. So go and click on the link in my bio to hear more about that and make sure you drop your email for early bird tickets. All right, get yourself comfortable and enjoy. Midwife Vic, I'm so excited to have you on. Why don't you tell everyone who you are and what makes you passionate?
Thank you, Poppy. I'm really excited to be here as well. I'm super, super excited. Hello, everyone. I am Midwife Vic. I am a midwife of nearly a decade now. I am a hypnobirth teacher. I work for the UK Resus Council. I'm an educator. I'm a speaker. I do a little bit of everything. And I'm really, really excited to be here today. I'm a huge fan of you, Poppy, and everything that you're doing. So yeah, super excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just dive in, shall we? So we're talking about how to avoid unnecessary intervention, because of course we know that some interventions are needed. But firstly, in your view, why are we where we are in terms of the intervention rates being so high?
Wow, where do we even start with this one? I think it's really interesting because it tells us a lot about the birth landscape that we face at the moment when we're talking about intervention. So I think the first thing to say is, one, it's a very big question. And two, we won't categorically find an answer for this today. But what we can do is start to speculate why the foundations of the birth landscape are changing so much so that intervention has changed as a result. I actually think that this starts with education, and I think it actually starts with staffing education. So we know that the midwifery voice is somewhat getting a little lost nowadays, in that the amount of midwives that we have are on the decline. And I think it's really important that we're careful what sort of language we use around this, because a lot of the time you hear people saying, oh, midwives are burnt out, when in fact I would suggest that the maternity system has burnt out midwives. One follows the other, right? Because that burden of responsibility is put on midwives a lot. And for the most part, midwives really want to help and care for women and advocate for women, but the system isn't allowing them to do that so much, I think. One, because they're hugely overstretched. They are between so many women at one given time. So the ability to give that really individualized and personalized care is incredibly challenging. And two, we're leaning more into an obstetric system now rather than a midwifery system. And we know from all of the research that has been done that if you're cared for by a midwife, your outcomes statistically and research based would suggest that you will have improved outcomes towards a normal physiological birth. Yeah, so I think the system itself is leaning more into an obstetric model now rather than a midwifery model, which we've seen in the past. We saw a more midwifery based model, then we saw more of a shared care where the two work together. And in theory, that is still what we have. However, the culture would suggest we're leaning more to an obstetric model. And I think, firstly, it's important to say obstetrics has its place. It definitely has its place. There are times when there is a deviation from normality and people become unwell throughout pregnancy or labor or birth, or their baby does. And having those specialists to be able to come in and manage abnormalities is really important. And we're really fortunate to have that as an option. However, it should be when there is an abnormality, because obstetricians treat problems. When there is an issue, they come in and they manage a problem. And it's important to know as well that their education around how they become an obstetrician is they learn how to fix problems. They come in when there is an issue and they help that person out with that issue by doing X, Y, and Z. But normal physiological labor and birth, actually, the specialist, the expert for that is a midwife. They're trained in normality before they then move on with their training to understand abnormalities. So I think The balance is just off kilt a little bit. That's what I would say about that. The balance has somewhat gone off kilt because now that the maternity system is largely led by my obstetric colleagues, sometimes that balance of risk is slightly tipped in the favor of trying to control absolutely everything, when in fact, we know that with normal physiological labor, there are parts of that that need to play out. We can't control them ahead of time. We have to allow that process to develop and move forward. And then the experts in normality will manage that as it happens, as it unfolds. And it's just having confidence in the physiological pathway of labor as well, I think.
Yes.
Not fearing it.
That's it.
Having confidence in it and knowing, and I understand people being frightened of it as well, by the way. So that's not to invalidate anybody's fear, because why wouldn't you be frightened of it? Everybody tells you it's absolutely terrifying. But actually, when you start getting a little bit more understanding and education around what's normal and what's not normal, then you start to get a bit more confidence in what's happening, especially what's happening to your body. And then if you have a practitioner who's with you who also has that confidence in what's normal and what's not normal, then you're cooking on gas, essentially. Yeah. That's a great partnership to be in. And then if you have an obstetrician who understands what's normal and what's not normal, which, you know, they do understand that, but knowing when to come in and when to hold back, I think, is really important. I think our culture is just, the balance has just tipped ever so slightly, because we are now in a very litigious culture, a litigious situation where people are frightened about risk because they're frightened of the consequence of risk. Whilst there should be some concern around risk and some management of risk within obstetrics and labour and birth, because we're dealing with incredibly precious situations that things can change quite quickly, there has to be a balance of risk, I think. And when I say balance of risk, what I mean by that is understanding the risk of doing something, but also the risk of doing nothing, and balancing those two off against one another.
Makes so much sense. And that balancing is so in the moment, right? It definitely feels like with labor, as a doula, I've seen this, there's just so many choices and moments where you have to make choices. It's very rarely, right now, there's a real emergency. This needs to happen right this second. There's usually some sort of give where you're weighing up the risks and the benefits of the options and taking on board the healthcare provider's view. But one thing I want to pick up on is the fear, because this is something that I've witnessed as a doula, where I'm in a position of fully trusting the physiology to play out in the way that it mostly does. And then I've got a clinician who wants to perform an intervention because maybe they're not trusting that it's going to play out as it does.
Yeah. And I think going back to my original point of the maternity system and the fact that we haven't had the investment in the maternity system, that's really where it starts in terms of the system becoming broken, because clinicians need good education and they need good support from their team as well, because the decision making that they are presenting to women and their support team, doula, partner, they're big decisions, and sometimes they are decisions or choices to be made in a matter of minutes, like you just explained.
So how does one go about avoiding the interventions that are unnecessary, and will we even ever know that they were unnecessary?
I think with this one, it's about deconstructing that sentence a little bit. For me, how do we avoid unnecessary intervention? Well, I think firstly, we need to decide what an intervention is. So we need to work from the back. What is an intervention to start off with? Because sometimes things happen or choices are presented to us and we're not really aware that it is an intervention because it's not presented as such. Because it's so normalized that we don't actually see it as an intervention to normality. And what I would say to the listeners is, it can be very overwhelming, I think, being a pregnant woman and feeling like you have to have control of every single situation. And I think the burden of responsibility is somewhat felt by women sometimes. You cannot control everything. We need to validate the fact that you just can't. It's about understanding and learning tools to be able to manage the situation that you're in. and gather information, and also learn that you can cast a net and gather that information and have that pause before decision making, so that the situation that you find yourself in can be one that is more informed. If we're not getting an answer to, let's pick risk, for example, then we can pursue that a little bit. Nobody has explained the risks of the proposed intervention or omission. And if we're still not getting that information, we know through a bit of training that we've done in pregnancy that everything has benefits and risks. So we do need to have a balance on either side. We need that information. And if we're not getting it, we need to feel confident and empowered enough to go somewhere else to get it. It's a combination of education and confidence. And I think as well, on top of that, it's really tough going into hospital sometimes. It has sounds that are unfamiliar. It has people who stop being people and become characters because they have titles, which make them very important. They have a theatrical outfit, scrubs, and all of those things contribute to us feeling really, really overwhelmed, I think. From the woman's perspective, when you go in, all of those things build up like little bricks. And suddenly, when you have 10 or 20 bricks full of these unfamiliar and slightly overwhelming and slightly intimidating features that you're having to manage, suddenly your levels of adrenaline have just shot up. And now your ability to listen to the information that you're getting and make good decisions has gone down. And that's not because you're stupid, silly, you're not any of those things. You're just a human that's in an unfamiliar environment, being asked to make decisions about something that you don't know a lot about.
Yeah.
So I think slowing it down is really important. You usually have the time to really consider that information, but it's knowing that you can slow that down. And that's, I think, where the education comes in.
One of the things that comes up a lot for me when I'm speaking to my clients and people on social media is people saying that they're feeling very fearful about going into the hospital because of the intervention rates. And I think also what they're watching online and the kind of accounts that they're following. And so how does one make sure that they're informed, but not to the point where they're actually just terrified? Because I think if you're going to go into hospital, you have to have some level of trust in the healthcare team. Otherwise, you know, don't go there or find somewhere that you do feel safe at. I think going in fearful is just really not a good idea.
I think there is a degree of fear mongering sometimes that is across social media. And I think what can happen sometimes is due to bias, which we know plays into so many people, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, a picture can be painted about a particular character or a type of, you know, a staff member or a staff group or the hospital in general, which might not be as truthful as it's come across. And the first thing I would say is I think it's really important for women to be mindful of any content that leans too far into one opinion. I think what you're looking for is balance. And I know that that's a word we've used a lot in this podcast so far, but it really underpins pretty much everything, I would say, because there is a lot of information out there, and what you're looking for is balanced information, because there is no right or wrong way to do this. There is only the way that feels most comfortable for you. I always say to the people that I talk to, you shouldn't really know that person's opinion about what you should be doing. I think that's a real red flag when you are communicating with a birth worker, be it a midwife, an obstetrician, a doula. If they are saying, well, you should do X because that's what I would do, that's a red flag. Because those people are in that very privileged position working with you, who may be somewhat vulnerable, even though you might feel particularly empowered in your pregnancy journey. This is new territory. It's a lot of new information, and that in of itself can make you feel quite vulnerable. So if you are using social media accounts that don't feel balanced, if they lean one way and never tip the other way, I think that's possibly a warning flag to maybe explore other avenues and other accounts, other birth workers, speak to your midwife to just make sure that you're getting information on both sides, because it can lean quite dramatically in one direction rather than both.
That's a really good tip. Yeah, look for if they're leaning both sides? And also, how are their posts making you feel? If they pop up and you're constantly on edge or feeling anxious, then it's probably not a good account to be following.
I think it's actually really important to check your source as well. What credibility does that person have? What qualifications do they have? What experience do they have? Have they actually been at births? You know, have they been in that system? Have they worked alongside women who are birthing? I think all of those things are really important. There's a lot of face value stuff on social, isn't it? Because it pops up on your phone for a few seconds and it pops away again.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to just dive behind the curtain.
So we touched on induction, but before we talk about that, I wanted to talk about some of the common interventions that are offered. So for example, sweeps. Correct me if I'm wrong, but are they offered to everyone now at due date? Do most hospitals?
Yeah. So there was a bit of change in guidance around membrane sweeps. So membrane sweeps, by and large, will be offered to most women now. From 40 weeks, they can be offered by the midwife, and the midwife can perform the membrane sweep, and they don't need any additional instruction from an obstetrician. Prior to 40 weeks, they would need some instruction from an obstetrician. That is just, you know, a piece of written instruction. The obstetrician doesn't need to attend to perform the membrane sweep. It's just one of those policy things. By and large, membrane sweeps are offered to a lot of women as a form of low or no intervention attempts at getting them into labor. However, membrane sweeps are not no intervention, because it is an intervention. So it's how that information is presented to you. And then I think, again, we circle back to benefits, risks, alternatives again. So it's asking that information. So what are the benefits of a membrane sweep and what are the risks of a membrane sweep? So it's important that your clinician goes through those things with you so that you fully understand what you're consenting to. And then I think what's really important is understanding the process as well. If you do decide that a membrane sweep is something that you would like to have, on balance of the benefits and risks, which we can talk about in just a second, I think it's important to know how to go about a membrane sweep. There are management techniques that you can utilize that will make that membrane sweep, there are ways to manage that situation that will make it so much better. And this is really where we move into our hypnobirthing strategies, which I know that you teach to all of your clients. I think the communication from the clinicians is really important. Sometimes it can be lacking. Sometimes it can be brilliant. It does pose risks, which we do need to talk about before we move forward with it. Things like a small risk of infection. There is a small risk of popping the bag of waters that sits around the baby. And the popping of the waters in of itself doesn't pose a huge risk, but it's the domino effect of intervention that may follow should that popping of the waters happen that people need to be aware of. If labor does not ensue after the popping of the waters, what options and choices will come at a later point? You can also experience a little bit of bleeding from a membrane sweep, because the cervix itself is a very vascular part of the organ. You can experience some bleeding. You can experience a little bit of discomfort as well in terms of tightening. All of those things need to be laid on the table. You need to be aware of them before you can move forward. You also need to know the benefits of a membrane sweep as well. So there is research to suggest they can promote the production of prostaglandin, a naturally occurring hormone, but you have artificially stimulated it, which can soften the cervix and start to make changes towards labor. I think also when we're talking about benefits and risks of a membrane sweep, it's important to understand the context of where you're at, because if you have accepted an induction and you're in the hospital, it might be that a membrane sweep actually might be quite beneficial to you, because it might minimize the need for an induction.
Let's talk about induction, because as you said, it's a hot topic and obviously the rates are increasing. One of the things I heard Dr. Rachel Reed talk about is how with induction of labor, there's obviously the true medical need, so preeclampsia, that's resolved by, you know, having the baby out of you, basically. So that's like what she calls a true medical need. And then she talks about other reasons being in response to a variation of something normal. So post-dates might be a variation of normal. So talk to us about induction of labor.
What Dr. Rachel Reed has done there is she's used language that isn't often used around induction. That's where we need to start with the change, is the language around induction, because rates are so high with induction that it has become normalized. And maybe the explanation around what an induction is needs more clarity and the understanding of the context, for example, the real medical need versus an on-balance induction. What I often say is the word induction, forget about that word for a second, because it's so commonplace and it's so normalized that it has built up a narrative of its own. So let's just park that for a second and instead let's break down what we're being presented with when somebody says to us, you need to have an induction. Because what they're actually saying is, you need to stop the pregnancy and you need to deliver the baby. And that is safer than continuing the pregnancy. Because when we actually say it like that, it gives a bit more gravitas to the decision making around an induction, rather than, oh, you need an induction. Because actually that person is just presenting the fact that they believe, on the basis of the information that they have, which hopefully they're going to present to you, that your pregnancy is no longer safe to continue. It should stop and the baby should come out of you in some fashion. And then it's about talking about what those options are for getting the baby out of you as well. Because I think a lot of women are told, oh, well, you need an induction, when actually their preference might be a cesarean section birth in that instance. And that information isn't given to them. And that should not be gate kept from women. They should understand that that is a choice. Is it a choice that maybe holds more risk? Possibly. But it is a choice. And it's not that clinician's right to withhold that information. All of the information should be given, as well as the information around not having an induction. So I think the first thing is language, using the right language to understand the gravitas, the gravity of what an induction is. And then the second one is, of course, context. So understanding why this person has suggested an induction on the basis of it is no longer safe to continue the pregnancy and the baby should be delivered. Because what will follow, if we use that language, is an explanation of why it's no longer safe to continue the pregnancy and why it is safer for the baby to come outside of your body than be retained inside of your body and continue to grow, and what benefit there is to getting the baby outside of you. Is it a benefit to you? Is it a benefit to your baby? What is the condition that is posing risk or danger to you or your child? So I think it's all about language.
What about induction for post-dates? What are the risks of going past the due date? Because I went to 41 weeks and I remember going to those meetings and feeling like, oh gosh, like now I'm really doing something dangerous by going to 41 weeks. So talk to us about that, because I know that a lot of people listening will probably ending up in these conversations and in these situations.
It's really tough, isn't it? Firstly, let me say I really empathize with those that are listening to this who are faced with this situation, because I understand what you're going through somewhat at this point. I think it's important when we talk about induction for post states that we just do touch on medical need for induction, and are we best placed as birthing women or people that sit outside of that clinician headspace to decide what is medical need and what is not? Probably not, in the sense of you shouldn't have that responsibility. The responsibility lies with the clinician to tell you about the medical need. But the responsibility for us is gathering that information to make sure we have all of the information, because you're right, Poppy, what you said before. For example, preeclampsia is a very serious condition in pregnancy that is abnormal and that poses great risk to mum and baby if not managed appropriately. But even preeclampsia is not cut and dry, in the sense of it is on balance, sometimes daily, sometimes hourly. You know, it can get to the point where it's on balance hourly. What decision are we going to make? And that on balance is the balance of, do we continue with the pregnancy knowing that we have benefits of keeping baby in utero, growing that baby, growing those lungs, improving the strength of those lungs for breathing when the baby comes out, whilst we have risk to the mother? At the minute, we're okay with that. But as soon as it tips the other way, the benefit to the baby and increasing the strength of the lungs has now become less of a priority compared to the mother, because the risk has got a lot greater to the mother. The obstetricians, for sure, in this situation are incredibly helpful, fetal medicine experts. So I think using that concept of a seesaw with preeclampsia, if we apply that to an induction for post-dates, that's quite a helpful picture to have in our brains to understand a post-date's offer of induction, because it's like a seesaw of balance. The first thing to start with a post-date's induction is to break down the language around that. So what is post-dates? So across the world, most women are given a due date. This is worked out on your last menstrual period and more than often scan measurements as well, which we know have got a ratio of risk attached to them in terms of their accuracy. So there is already a window of inaccuracy with scans, which therefore ends up having a degree of inaccuracy with due dates. So that's the first thing. Before we get into what is post dates, let's think about due dates. So there can be some variability in the due date itself. A lot of people hang their hat on, you know, the 15th of March, for example, when in fact it's more of a window. The next thing to say is you are not a carton of milk, right? You don't just go off overnight. You are instead on a gradient, and that gradient is back to our seesaw again. So the reason that an induction is presented to women is because there is some research and understanding that as they move through 40 weeks to 41 weeks to 42 weeks, there is a statistical difference in risk to the baby. So I just want to pause on the word risk for a second, because when we're having conversations about risk to a baby, that language is really emotionally weighted. It's almost at the point of being slightly inappropriate language, I would say, because if you are a woman with a baby ready to give birth at some point, you love that baby and you would throw yourself in front of a truck if you had to save that baby. So if we say to you, oh, there's a risk to your baby if you continue to stand on your feet rather than your head, you will immediately do a headstand and get on your head because you've just heard that there's risk to your baby. But if we break that language down and say there is a 0.2% risk to your baby if you continue to stand on your feet rather than get on your head, you'll probably think, oh, well, if it's 0.2, then it's 99 point whatever percent. Yeah. Okay. So now the drama and gravity of the word risk is sort of minimized a little bit because we can put numbers to it. And numbers quantitate how we feel. It puts numbers on the paper, which gives us a more realistic idea about how risky is risk. What I think is important actually is education around this, the decision making of having an induction, but also education around having the induction itself. I think it's really important as birth educators to educate around induction if that is something that somebody chooses to have. But yes, in answer to the question around, you were at 41 weeks and you felt, oh my goodness, I'm putting my baby at risk. That's probably the language that was used.
I had four clients all this year, actually, that went past 42 weeks. And one of the things that they said to me is that they felt that there was just no support and that it was like, you're going to the no-go zone. We don't really know much about what could happen here. That's on you, basically. And yeah, like, they just felt that they weren't really supported in their decision to wait.
I think if anybody is in a unit that has like a consultant midwife, that can often be a good person to speak to. When you pursue a pregnancy, a labour, a birth choice that sits outside of hospital guidance or policy, the bulk of staffing, they work in those hospital policies and guidelines. That's the reality of maternity. So when you choose to opt outside of them, a consultant midwife can be, or a senior midwife. Some hospitals don't necessarily have a consultant midwife, but they may have a, you know, particular senior midwife that does a lot of counselling, who is, you know, well positioned to be a good communicator. That can be a good person to seek an appointment with.
Okay, because, that's a really good point. Yeah.
They can be sort of a bit of a neutral ground. Sometimes the bulk of midwives that you see in, say clinic or the ward, they may have another 20 women to see. And actually that conversation needs time, really more than anything. Mm-hmm. You can't rush that conversation because if a statistical risk has changed, that person needs to know the benefits, risks, and alternatives to the intervention or the omission of intervention, so they're not doing the intervention. And that conversation is not 5 minutes.
Well, we've covered a lot today, Midwife Vic. Yeah. I feel like we need to do a live Q&A together, maybe pre-festival, get everyone signed up, do a big free online Q&A, because I'm sure that people will be listening to this being like, I want to ask questions. What would you say your final tips are as a midwife, as a hypnobirthing teacher, final tips for how people can set themselves up for a good birth experience?
Number one, education. Absolutely starts with education. Knowledge is power, and what we're familiar with, we fear less. And it's all about removing that fear, instilling confidence and empowerment. And that comes from knowledge. It comes from understanding your body. It comes from understanding physiology. It comes from understanding the system that you will be moving into, navigating your choices, your options. So I think it starts with education. That's my first top tip. My second top tip is support, which seems a bit tween, a bit cheesy, but actually it's exactly what you need if you're about to labor and birth. Parts of your brain that you use through labor and birth are not the same parts of your brain that you use for really difficult conversations, decision-making, choices. So actually having somebody alongside you who can use that part of their brain while you're using the other part of your brain that you need for labor and birth can be really helpful. Having a really supportive partner is really helpful. For some women, their partner might be fantastic, but might not be well positioned to navigate some of those conversations. They may be, you know, their personality might not lean into that. And that's to no detriment to them. I'm sure they're a wonderful partner. So actually utilizing someone like yourself, Poppy, a doula, can be really helpful. A third party person who isn't the midwife caring for you and delivering your baby or helping you to birth your baby can be helpful because they're actually used to birth. They're used to some of the atmosphere and the big changes in birth. They're used to the environments that you're going to be in. And that familiarity breeds confidence and knowledge in how to navigate a system. So I think having a supportive team in place, whether it's a doula, whether it is your birth partner, maybe it's your birth partner plus someone else, you know, your mum or a friend who has really dedicated and committed the time to really educate themselves and really prep themselves as well as help you to prep. So education, support, and it's a super cheesy one to end on, but believe in yourself as well.
I love that. Yeah, I always say that. Yeah.
You know, we doubt ourselves every day in life. We really do. And believe in yourself is a skill, and it's also a skill to be practiced. So I think it's the practice and the repetition of these things that will really pay off when it's needed.
All right. And where can people find you? What sort of services could you offer to people if they, you know, if they want to work with you perhaps? And then also talk to us about C-section UK. We need to know what's going on with that.
Yes, that's a big thing. So you can find me across Instagram and TikTok as Midwife Vic. Well, firstly, you may see me soon alongside you, Poppy.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what I can say and what I can't say, but you'll definitely see me and Poppy together soon. By the way, anybody listening, me and Poppy could talk for about 7 hours and then still keep going.
Yeah, you're going to get 40 minutes of the, I don't know, 70 minutes that we've been chatting.
We can talk all day. So yes, you can find me across TikTok, Instagram. You'll see me soon with Poppy, but I'm sure she'll tell you more about that. I do teach hypnobirthing privately, so you can find that across the Midwife Vic page. I also work with lots and lots of brands. So I'm Mamma Mio Skincare's resident midwife, where over on their channel, you'll see me every month answering your questions and giving you top tips on labor and birth. And then I work with other brands as well. So you might see my face popping up left, right, and center. I might even help you birth your baby because I do actually still work clinically as well. I also work with the UK Rhesus Council. The most amount of my time is I am the founder of C-section UK. So C-section UK is a digital platform offering digital education around cesarean section birth. We know that C-section birth is on the rise, and that conversation is separate to what C-section UK is trying to do. We know that C-section births are on the rise, and we want to cater for those women because despite the trend going up and possibly a conversation around whether that should be happening, these women are having C-section births and they're left after their C-section births unsure how to recover, really, because the maternity system is so overstretched that women are being discharged so quickly from hospital. Around 200,000 women will have a cesarean section birth, or just under, every year across the UK. So our three courses, prep, birth and recovery, go into huge detail about the C-section journey, everything that you can do before your C-section, during, and then of course after, all the way up to a few months after your C-section birth.
So if someone's had an emergency cesarean, can they purchase like an after section?
Yeah, they can. Okay. So our three courses can be bought in a bundle, or you can buy a course separately. So for example, if you had an emergency C-section birth, you can of course come and purchase our recovery course afterwards. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm really proud of it, to be honest, because what I found in clinical practice was these women were left with nowhere to go after their C-section births. And that should never happen. That's a human rights issue, that women are having a 7-layer abdominal surgery and not being given the appropriate information to be able to recover well from a surgery that is going to have an impact on the rest of their lives. So it was really important to me to move forward with C-section UK. And we're a team of 8 now, which is exciting. We have a number of midwives and birth trauma practitioners as well. And I really like some of the key bits in our courses. In our birth course, we have sound effects. So you get to be familiar with some of the sounds of theatre before you're in theatre.
Wow, fascinating.
Sound of instruments, the sounds of beeping machines, all of those things are really key. And one of the fundamental values across our courses is that it's really important for me for women to know that they can use hypnobirthing techniques for a C-section birth. Because I think a lot of women who find themselves having a C-section birth feel that they can now no longer have any control and they're not able to use hypnobirthing. It's gone out the window. And of course, Poppy, we know that's not true. Hypnobirthing is not a type of birth. It's a way to approach birth. And there are so many of the techniques that translate over to different type of births with ease and will really help elevate your experience. And then there's just some real practical information in there as well, like how to look after your scar. The entire team are just so passionate women having this information. Our team are clinician based, so we have everyone from a surgical assistant who actually performs C-section births. We have a number of midwives. We have our resident physiotherapist as well. So we all come from clinical backgrounds, and we've sort of pooled all of those resources together.
The difficulty is you finding the people. Like,
yeah,
you know, you've had a cesarean. How do people find you? Anyway, we're talking forever now.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, thank you so much. I can't wait to be talking to you more, actually, because we're going to be getting into the planning of the big festival, which people, by the time this is out, there'll be more information on the link. And yeah, thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me, Poppy. And let me say as well, thank you for, you know, hosting this podcast, doing all the work that you're doing, because it's really, really important. And women need information like this. So well done to you, and thank you for doing what you're doing, and thank you for having me.